Blog Talk Radio.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Let's face the music and dance. The moon humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Let's face the music and dance.
Hi, you boys and girls. Welcome to the Spirit of America Party and the Spirit of America Party book. I think chapter 2 in my book is intelligence, which we have none of. Are you going to tell me that this pot that's been boiling for years all of a sudden erupted and nobody saw it coming in our country? Why are we paying the CIA? Why are we paying the FBI? Why are we paying the NSA? Why are we paying naval intelligence? You know, the last time I saw a lack of naval intelligence, it was two troop ships that carried like 1,200 Marines each, and they pulled into Jordan, into Aqaba, Jordan, and they were parked at the dock, and nobody sent two or three guys to go check out the warehouses alongside the ships. And do you know a mortar team launched an attack on the ships and the ships had to pull out? That was almost another Cole. We do not have good intelligence. We could not win World War II with the intelligence we have today. So I picked up my newspaper, somebody blogged, or it was news on the internet. And you want to know how secure New York City is? New York City is so secure from an attack that our mayor has the time to send an undercover group of a New York City policemen to Arizona to go to a gun show and buy weapons. Is he sending a message? Who's the message for? Who's the message for? The last time I heard somebody screaming in New York, you know what the scream was? Don't run into the subways. You know when that was? That was 911. So this jerk of a mayor announces that he sent an undercover team to Phoenix to buy guns at an Arizona gun show. No wonder the city is broke with the cost of polusia and junkets. Come back to New York and roll those dice at the full of crap table, guys. How about going undercover at a gun show in Bed-Stuy or at a marijuana smoke-in? How about going undercover as a jihadist and planning to turn Liberty Plaza into a holy ammunition dump under the freedom of religion ploy? This is not a sting operation. This is a it stinks operation. New York under Mayor Crotch became a sanctuary city for illegal immigrants. Now Imam Bloomingdale has made New York a sanctuary for Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Democrat Party. What's the difference between an Iranian who burns the American flag in Tehran and Chuck Schumer, Mad Anthony Weiner, Congress Mice, Nallet and Ackerman, and Phony Maloney? The Iranian tells the truth when he says he hates America. The others pretend to care. Imagine voting to burn the 343 flags that fly on St. Paddy's Day up Fifth Avenue in memory of 343 firemen. And still, Anthony Weiner got the endorsement of the New York City Fire Department. Who forgot who? When did this Republican mayor turn Grey Poupon communist slash fire worshiper have to give the keys to the city to New York's 10th Mountain Division? Did he ever call up the Four Drum and say, send the boys down this weekend, it's a slow week, we can entertain them instead? No. Won't do it. Wouldn't even consider it. Never even got the thought. When did this mayor ever give an empty Broadway show, give the seats to visiting GIs and their sweethearts? When did he buy a latte for a wounded vet? When did he ever ask hotels with empty rooms to comp a guy in uniform? When did he ever say thank you to those who bleed so we can stay freed? Giving him a paid for third term was a giant mistake. Leave the people of Arizona alone. Pay attention to the two blocks you pretend to govern. We know you appointed the head of Community Board 1, that witch who sold out 3,000 families and 200 unborn pro-life babies who died with their pro-life mothers. Why don't you run for mayor of Cairo and stop playing rich cop? And that's my little blog on Mayor Bloomingdale, the scourge of God. Hang in there, and when I come back, we're going to read chapter 10 of Red Cocaine. We'll give you a quick eye of the tiger. Back. That was a quick eye of the tiger, wasn't it? Okay. Let me just make sure we're back, and we'll pay a tribute to one of the last remaining fighting units. Oh. Maybe we're not back. Let's see.
Wise men
that fools run. But I can't help falling in love with you. Shall I stay? Would it be a sin if I can't help falling in love with you? Like a river flows surely to the sea, darling, so it goes. Some things are meant to be.
Country back, you got to get rid of all the lobbyists in Washington. The lobbyists that you see are big business, but drugs is big business, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, what wasn't making money went down the drain, but what was making money is still in existence. So chapter 10 is Questions of Intelligence. How could a massive global Soviet bloc intelligence operation such as the Soviet Narcotics Offensive have been underway for so long without the United States knowing what was happening? This is a most important and potentially explosive question. Oh, by the way, I'm watching World War II and how the Japanese expanded their imperialist empire. And do you know that they were, in 1940, they were buying DC-3s here in the United States so they could copy them and build better ones. And do you know where they got the money from to pay for them? From the opium trade in China in the 1940s. This is a most important and potentially explosive question. Now remember, this topic is questions of intelligence. Implicit in it are a number of additional questions. For example, what else are we unaware of, and how else might we have been misled? Okay, this is in the 60s, the 68, 70s, 80s, creeping up to the 90s, and they had 20 more years on top of that. To a degree, the question, why haven't we known, is answered in the previous chapter. Part of the answer involves political and private interests. That's why there can only be one man, one vote, $1. Send a dollar to elect somebody, and GE sends $1. And and all the other big companies send a dollar. Two aspects are particularly relevant. The inner workings of U.S. intelligence. The first involves the collection and evaluation of intelligence, specifically in this case, the detailed handling of General Major Jan Sagina's debriefing. That's the guy from Czechoslovakia who defected. The second aspect, understanding how Soviet bloc intelligence operations work and communication of this understanding. Let us consider, first of all, the debriefing. Before I forget, you see the crowds, there's going to be a million Egyptians out in the streets tomorrow. You gotta ask yourself how many are well-intentioned and how many are being duped. And how many really know the real objective. And Savage is talking tonight. He's saying, why did the Christians like Mubarak? Because Mubarak protected them. There's 10 million Coptic Egyptians. And you know what? If the Islamists take over, there'll be 10 million Coptic Christians entering the United States asking for asylum. General Sagina defected to the United States in Trieste, February 25, 1968. The usual procedure is that preliminary debriefings of defectors in Europe are conducted at a special debriefing facility near Frankfurt, Germany. In Sagina's case, this was not done. Rather, he was immediately flown to Washington. This might be because of his rank or unusual importance. If it were not for the fact that his subsequent debriefing and handling was more apropos, a low-level defector. Nevertheless, his rapid transportation to Washington does suggest that someone somewhere may have wanted to exercise strict and immediate control over his debriefing. The news of Sagina's defection to the United States, along with a brief description of the circumstances, was published in the Communist Washington Post and the Communist New York Times. I put that in there. In the week following his defection. So they blurted it right out. In other words, they were cluing in their Soviet counterparts. The description of Sagina in the articles was rather vague. He was described as a chief of the Communist Party at the Ministry of Defense, a member of the General Staff and of the Presidium of the National Assembly. Those were the only particulars to be published. While acknowledging that Sagina was one of the highest-ranking communists ever to defect, the Communist Washington Post, instantly played down his importance by noting that Sagina was simply of higher rank than either of the previous year's defectors, Svetlana Stalin and Lieutenant Colonel Renge. The only hints of his importance were statements that he had top-secret information on his country's defense and on Warsaw Pact operations. Aside from the foregoing, there is no information or even speculation in the Washington Post or the New York Times concerning the full spectrum of Sagina's positions, responsibilities, or knowledge. Rather, both papers focused attention on material designed to defame Sagina, which had been published in the Communist press. And they're doing that tonight. There was no indication of any attempt to learn more in any respect to challenge the descriptions of Sagina that had appeared in the Communist press, specifically in order to discredit him. General Sagina was certainly not presented as an official of even moderate importance, notwithstanding the fact that he was probably one of the five most knowledgeable Czech officials as regards Soviet bloc political, military, and intelligence strategy and objectives. Rather, he was described as an embezzler, a Stalinist, a public school dropout, an individual who had been promoted through favors and against the recommendations of his peers, one who had organized an abortive coup against the new liberal Czechoslovak leadership, and who had defected with his son and a young woman who, as the Washington Post wrote, is being described officially here as the general's 22-year-old mistress. The young woman was, in fact, his son's fiancée. They were later married in the United States. So you see, you can go back to the 60s, and you can see the media slamming women, right? The young woman was, in fact, his son's fiancée, like they do to Sarah Palin. The only one they looked up to was Monica Lewinsky, who was looking up to the president. The young woman was, in fact, his son's fiancée. These characteristics of Sejina are all false and constitute a pertinent example of a communist character assassination, which is the tactic that's used by the Democrats today, and are all false and constitute a pertinent example of a communist character assassination. Being picked up and echoed by leading newspapers. U.S. newspapers. The importance of this type of shallow reporting, which goes on today, and the failure of the U.S. government to correct the record should not be underestimated. These reports, in effect, told people that Sejina was not a credible source nor an individual of any value. The reports materially damaged his opportunities to use his background as a basis for a new career. For example, teaching, speaking engagements, writing, and consulting. They also, in effect, discouraged anyone in the intelligence or national security committees from seeking him out or listening to what he had to say. How could anyone trust an individual with such a reputation? It should also not go unnoticed that when the charges were made, Sejina did not speak or read English and was not aware of how his credibility and thus his future was being undermined. He was unable to defend himself. The image of Sejina, portrayed in the Washington Post and the New York Communist Times, was perhaps best summarized by his description published in Newsweek a week and a half later. Up until now, Americans could always fall back on one sure test. If an East European defected to the West, he was ipso facto a good guy. Last week, however, Washington unveiled its latest defector, only to discover that he was the heavy, that is, a villain, in the case. To make certain the message had been adequately communicated, Newsweek printed a picture of Sejina with the caption, "Sejina, the heavy in the case." Newsweek is also, that's also one of the GE, Soviet GE dupes. And I have no respect for Newsweek whatsoever. And all they did was slander all the Americans who died in Iraq. Newsweek sucks. As a matter of fact, my parakeets refuse to use it at the bottom of the cage. Namely, that Sejina was running away with a 22-year-old mistress, which was a lie, as indicated above. To a degree, the official U.S. handling of Sejina was understandable. It does not seem that even within the CIA or the U.S. State Department, there was anyone equipped to clarify the record who had possessed any real appreciation of how important a defector Sejina actually was. For example, he was a political officer, a commissar. Political commissars are generally regarded in the United States as thugs or watchdogs who report on their friends and acquaintances to authorities. They are not held in high regard or seriously considered in any sense of the word. Accordingly, just this one aspect of Sejina's background is sufficient to have caused most people to discount his value. Additionally, there was little knowledge of the organizations that Sejina was a member of or the positions he held. U.S. officials throughout the intelligence and diplomatic communities are not known to have appreciated the role of the Collegium, which functioned almost as a mini defense council and served within the Ministry of Defense to review and critique plans and issues prior to their being sent forward to the Defense Council or to party group at the Presidium, which exercised party control over the National Assembly, the Parliament, or of the Bureau, which provided the direction to the main political administration, which in turn was responsible for maintaining ideological watch over the military, or of the powerful administrative organs department, which ruled over the military, civilian intelligence, and justice. These were just some of the organizations in which Sejina had held leadership positions. U.S. officials evidently did not know what it meant to be a chief of the Communist Party, that is, first secretary at the Ministry of Defense, in which capacity Sagina monitored all top-level Czechoslovak decisions and communications to and from other countries, including the Soviet Union, and exercised a nomenklatura, position appointment power, over all mid-level military officers. Most of the Soviet bloc intelligence experts did not even know a defense council existed, let alone what its function was or what it meant for Sagina to be its secretary and in charge of the defense council agenda. Now, this is all drugs, and you see with councils, with defense council, every top government officials are in this drug game. And Junior can't wait to run out tonight and buy weed, because it's good for his soul. The preparation of decisions and the dissemination of implementing directives. Thus, it is entirely possible that there was no U.S. official in a position to know and take appropriate action who understood how truly important a defector Sagina was. At the time, there were several glaring inconsistencies and departures from normal practice, such as, one, the lack of an initial debriefing in Europe. Two, the manner in which Sagina's CIA debriefing was terminated, which will be described later. Three, what appears to have been an immediate decision to exercise strict control over his debriefings, keeping them focused on tactical military matters and away from topics of possible strategic significance. And four, at the same time, a decision to discredit Sagina so that no one would actively seek him out or listen to what he had to say. While these decisions were made within the U.S. government, it seems more probable than not that the decisions were not based upon bureaucratic self-interest or policy considerations, but were orchestrated, on the contrary, by Soviet intelligence or agents of influence. So you see, you compromised. The logic behind this hypothesis will become more evident during the following description of what happened, and more particularly, what did not happen. Sagina's debriefing began in a normal manner. First, the debriefings focused on questions of tactical warning, the possibility of an imminent attack, security codes, alert measures, and conditions. Items of immediate military significance. Following the potentially time-sensitive questions, the debriefings shifted to questions of a personal and professional nature. This was the establishment of the bona fides phase, which had its problems because the people conducting the CIA briefings did not understand the communist system, had many misperceptions, and hence often did not like Sagina's responses to their questions. After General Sagina's bona fides had been established, the debriefings finally settled down to a probe of Czechoslovak and Warsaw Pact military organization and operations. There were several serious questions about the nature of Sagina's... serious questions about the nature of Sagina's debriefings arise. The debriefings, which lasted roughly 10 months, were confined to questions relating to matters of technical military significance. And while Sagina's knowledge in these matters was unquestionably extensive, these subjects were at the same time the least important ones of which Sagina had detailed knowledge. Moreover, some of the debriefings were so trivial that they properly should be regarded as strictly ways to pass time and maintain the image of being busy. Sagina was asked, for example, to sketch the different Czechoslovak military insignias, which, as he told his debriefers, were freely available in the library across the street from the U.S. Embassy in Prague. General Sagina had also turned over to the CIA secret and top-secret documentation he had brought with him, carefully selected by him for its wide-ranging importance. He was never asked one question about these documents or the material they contained. You know, when they run up to Baghdad, and when we set the record for getting into the capital city, what was it, like 23 days or 27 days we were in Baghdad? One of the, as soon as we hit the palace and we hit the military intelligence, the first thing that we did was load a 40-foot container full of documents and ship them back to the United States to our intelligence people. I think 4 years later, only 1% of the documents had been read. And I used to joke that the reason that's all they could read was that Mustafa in the Shell station had quit. So he had turned over top-secret documentation. The failure to debrief a Sagina cannot be excused on the ground that the CIA debriefers did not know that Sagina possessed information of prime strategic significance. Often following the sessions, he would chat with his debriefers and tell them that they were not asking the right questions. Also, one of the first things Sagina's told his debriefers was that, in his opinion, the most important information he brought with him was his detailed knowledge of the Soviet long-range plan for the next 10 to 15 years and beyond, that he would not discuss this plan, which detailed the Soviet bloc's coordinated strategy and tactics around the world, until a decision to grant him political asylum had been made. But after that decision was made, and continuing to the present, there was no effort to debrief Sagina on the contents of the Soviet plan to bury us. This was and continues to be a most serious error. In 1975, the importance of Sagina's knowledge of the Soviet long-range plan was made public by Lord Chalfont in a series of three articles in the Times of London. Even so, no attempt to debrief Sagina was made, nor subsequently in 1983 after Walter Hahn, the editor of Strategic Review, wrote about Sagina's knowledge. He has still, 1990, has not been debriefed on the long-range plan, and given the nature of Soviet intentions, goals, and strategies, which had not materially changed in over 70 years, and one of the objectives, most of the objectives, strategies, and operational concepts set forth in the long-range plan probably remain valid to this day. Unbelievable. So, in the late spring of 68, General Sagina was made available to a Defense Intelligence Agency debriefing team, which consisted of two warrant officers, a major, and on a few occasions, two colonels, none of whom seemed to Sagina to have any background or interest in political, military, or intelligence strategy, policy, or objectives. Their debriefings were also confined to matters of tactical military significance, for example, tables of organization and equipment for small units such as companies and battalions and unit locations. As a further indication of the CIA's attitude towards Sagina during the Defense Intelligence Agency debriefings, the DIA officers also addressed Sagina as General Sagina out of military courtesy and respect. Then one day in Sagina's presence, the CIA handler directed these DIA officers not to refer to him as General any longer because the Czechoslovak Politburo had taken away his rank. During Sagina's debriefing throughout 68, and for many years thereafter, there was and still is no indication of any serious top-level U.S. intelligence or national security interest in what he has to say. He was not taken to meet any high CIA officials, such as Richard Helms, who was then the CIA director, or his deputies, or any key officials within the operations directorate, such as James Angleton, whose counterintelligence intelligence office exercised cognizance over General Sugina from 1970 until the office was broken up in 74. Nor, for that matter, was he taken to see Angleton's deputies, not even the one who was directly responsible for Sugina from 1970 to 1975. And while Sugina was scheduled to visit Congress on four or five occasions, each time the visit was canceled. Why and by whom has not been divulged. But these are important questions. Perhaps the most important inconsistency during Sugina's debriefing occurred in 68, when the former U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, Llewellyn Thompson, then a senior State Department advisor on Soviet affairs, came to visit him. Why such a high-ranking U.S. State Department official would want to visit Sugina, given the way in which he was described and officially debriefed, is curious to say the least. Did he visit Sugina on his own initiative or in response to another person's request or suggestion? Thompson began the conversation by asking Sugina if he thought communism was changing. Sugina answered no. The strategy, the objectives as set forth by Lenin, there has been no change in these objectives and neither was any change likely. Thompson responded sharply, advising Sugina that he was wrong. And the conversation went downhill and soon ended. What a terrible thing to do. Here you're trying to get information from a guy and the first thing you do is turn him off? You don't do that. You got to learn to listen. These politicians who are now holding intelligence offices, they never shut up. They're in love with themselves. Thompson was the only high-ranking official whom Sugina recalls came to see him. At the mid-level, things were no better. Only two individuals of moderate rank visited Sugina, the deputy head and the Czechoslovak desk officer of the CIA's Soviet bloc division. Presumably, Sugina's debriefings would have been controlled by this division, but these two people apparently did not come to question Sugina. They came only to visit informally. Both spoke Czech, one having immigrated from Czechoslovakia prior to World War II, and the other having served as a military attaché in the U.S. Embassy in Prague. Both were introduced to Sugina under false names, which Sugina immediately recognized because both individuals were among those that Sugina and other Czechoslovak officials had been warned about on numerous occasions during KGB counterintelligence briefings that were a regular part of Czechoslovak and Soviet internal security practices. So he knew them, but they didn't know him. Sugina, who had an extremely well-disciplined memory, recalled with ease their pictures, correct names, and backgrounds as provided by the KGB. What the CIA officials were after, or why they did not show any apparent interest in what Sugina really had to say, is not known. However, it is almost inconceivable that anyone in such a position would fail to recognize that Sugina was no ordinary defector and that his main value lay not in what he had to contribute to our understanding of Warsaw Pact tactical military matters, but rather in his first-hand knowledge of strategic importance. For example, Soviet political, military, and intelligence strategy and decision-making. Indeed, that this was recognized by someone would seem to explain a second visit by Ambassador Thompson. When the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia in late August of 68, Sugina asked that he be allowed to speak out and explain to the American public and to statesmen around the globe what was happening in Czechoslovakia, including detailed background information on Soviet preparations for the invasion, which Sugina had recognized well in advance would probably take place. Sugina was most insistent, which was the reason behind Thompson's second visit. In this case, Thompson's visit was certainly not self-initiated. Thompson was summoned to discourage Sagina from telling his story to the public. He quickly explained to Sagina that it was not in the interest of the U.S. government to publish and describe what was happening, and Sagina disagreed. See, everybody has a version of what freedom is in America, and we are all being fooled. Then Thompson communicated a clear threat. He told Sagina that Czechoslovakia had requested Sagina's return and that Prague's request might be honored if Sagina were to make trouble. How's that? You come believing that this is the land of the free and the home of the brave, because that's what they show you in World War II movies. Sagina told Thompson that this was not possible because under the United Nations Charter, the United States could not return him to Czechoslovakia or any other Soviet bloc country. Again, the conversation deteriorated rapidly. When it was clear that he was not about to change Sagina's mind, Thompson advised Sagina that he should not tell the United States what we can do and abruptly terminated the meeting. At this point, additional questions arise. Who called Thompson and requested his assistance, and why? Why is it not in the U.S. interest to have the invasion explained to the U.S. public and the rest of the world? Most importantly, who was pulling the strings? Hang in there, I got to take a sip. In deference to Sagina's request, he was placed in contact with a reporter from the New York Times, and he's in trouble. Richard Etter, who offered the opportunity to go up to New York at his own, Sagina's own expense, and tell what he wanted to say. This he did, and then was shocked at the manner in which the interview was written up. As Sagina described the articles, Etter did not use any of the most important facts behind the invasion. For example, the 7 months advanced preparation twisted much of what Sagina had to say to compromise him, and lied about the interview in a manner that made Sagina look like a primitive. He called Etter in New York and complained bitterly. Etter's reply was that it was not his fault. His editors were responsible for the final form. How's that? I don't know why the New York Times is allowed to exist. They should fold by default. There should be no money coming into them. That's the thing. You want to vote with your pocketbook. Notwithstanding the nature of the reporting, a moderately informed reader would still have to wonder what else Sagina had to say about politically important events in which the Soviet Union had participated. Nor were the Etter articles the sole reason that someone should have reached or clearly did reach this conclusion. Neither does it seem credible that Sagina's information on the long-range plan was overlooked by accident. In the summer of 68, one of Sagina's CIA handlers advised him to write his story, which could be published and provide him a good income. Sagina set to work in the evenings writing his story. His son's fiancée typed the manuscript, which the CIA had translated into English as it was being produced. The manuscript ran over 300 pages and was completed just before Christmas of that year. It did not deal with tactical military matters. It set forth Sagina's background, including the various positions he held, his steady interaction with the highest-level communist leaders from all countries, and of special importance, the nature and dimensionality of Soviet long-range strategy and the world revolutionary process. Again, it is inconsistent with the nature of the intelligence process to believe that this material was not reviewed within the CIA division responsible for Sagina. Nor does it seem likely that anyone with responsibilities for intelligence on Soviet bloc operations could have read the document and not understand that here was a source of immense value or danger, depending on one's perspective, and a defector who had been totally misbriefed. When Sagina's first draft had been completed in mid-December 1968, he gave a copy to the Reader's Digest. The CIA had allowed a Reader's Digest editor to meet and interview Sagina. During their conversation, Sagina mentioned the book he was writing. The editor had asked to see a copy when it was finished. Evidently, they liked what they saw because they prepared a contact to publish the book in 5 short articles, which Sagina signed. What happened next is of paramount significance. Okay, hang in there. I'm going to give you a tune and take a break. I think it was 5 guys. Pure Americana. Innocent, in love with one girl, and one out of those 5 guys died a junkie. Isn't that sad? Isn't that sad? How would you like to be in a baby ward and see 20 kids in bassinets and knowing that 5 of them will be taken down by drugs? What happened next is of paramount significance. Where we've got 11 minutes left. We won't finish chapter 10, to be continued. But I'll give you what I got in the remaining time that I have left. As a senior member of James Jesus Angleton's counterintelligence staff explained, almost immediately after President Nixon's inauguration in January 1969, a directive was sent from the White House to the CIA ordering them to cease debriefing Sagina immediately, and in the process of getting rid of him, not to give him a job in the U.S. government. So Nixon got him. Even more amazing than this, White House interest in a Czechoslovak defector who had been so unimportant that he had only been worth debriefing about tactical Military Matters, where the lengths to which the CIA went to implement the White House directive as far as was humanly possible. Sugina was told that the debriefings had been terminated, and the next day he was moved out of the safe house. Without arranging for a new identity for Sugina or paying any evident attention to Sugina's personal security, the CIA proceeded to help Sugina find a house to rent in Maryland. On almost his first day in the new house, the U.S. Postal Service delivered an envelope addressed to General Sugina from a real estate agent. It was his copy of the rental agreement. The actual rent, he learned, was more than the stipend he was receiving from the CIA. He next learned that his neighbor was a Bulgarian diplomat. Finally, in the process of locating a school for his son's fiancée's brother, who had defected in August 1968, and after several months had been reunited with his sister, he had asked the CIA to see if the local school was safe. He was told they had checked it out, and it was, only to learn later that the children of 10 Czechoslovak diplomats were there attending the school. Can all this be excused as oversight or as an unfortunate string of coincidences? Was he being taught a lesson, or was the object to let the Soviets know where to find Sugina? Then he was told there was no job for him in Washington. Notwithstanding the initial agreement he had to reach with the CIA, which included productive employment, schooling for his son, and the stipulation that his son should not be drafted to serve in Vietnam, his son had a fused disc in his back, as conditions for Sugina's cooperation. The CIA reneged on all three provisions. The whole manner in which Sugina's debriefings was first carefully controlled and restricted to tactical military area, notwithstanding Sugina's suggestion of more important areas for inquiry and then precipitously terminated, raises serious questions. It would seem that someone with control mechanisms deep within the CIA and with access to the White House knew that Sugina was an explosive time bomb that needed to be defused. Clearly, Sugina's knowledge placed in jeopardy numerous Soviet bloc operations, methods, agents, and plans. The problem was certainly recognized by the controlling powers the instant his defection became known. It also seems that his importance was unlikely to have been known by CIA or White House officials because of limitations in their own background knowledge, as previously described. The debriefing process kept Sugina out of the way for a year, but the emergence of his manuscript could well have underscored the need to seek a more permanent solution. Whatever the cause, the same powers that controlled the process may have recognized that additional measures were required. Timing is the essence of success in intelligence work. The confusion within the new Nixon administration provided an ideal cover for displacing the threat that Sugina represented, hence the White House directive following the inauguration. The question is, who took the decision? It seems reasonable to conclude that more than one person was involved, just as more than one person would have been needed to control the debriefing process so completely and effectively for 10 months. The operation appears to have enjoyed advanced CIA White House coordination. That is, the skids appear to have been well greased. Otherwise, implementation by the CIA would not have proceeded so expeditiously. If at all, might there have been a linkage between the completion of Sugina's manuscript and its submission to Reader's Digest, or was everything planned months in advance, only waiting for the turmoil associated with the arrival of the new administration for its implementation? As part of his book, a contract with the Reader's Digest, Sugina was to work with the Digest in writing 5 articles. The first was placed in motion April 69. It dealt with the seizure of the U.S. intelligence collection ship Pueblo,
by the North Koreans on January 23, 1968. In the article, Sugina set forth the time, place, and circumstances when he was informed by Marshal Andrei Grechel, the Soviet Minister of Defense, of the Soviet strategy to humble the U.S. intelligence collection program. Sugina described the entire Soviet strategy, including the logic underlying the use of the North Koreans and the Soviet excitement over the volume of intelligence they obtained when they briefed the top Czechoslovak leadership a few days before Sugina's departure for the West. What was particularly unfortunate about the failure of U.S. intelligence to have obtained the information about Soviet objectives and their use of North Korean intelligence is the possibility that the information, if obtained earlier, might have been used to avoid the shooting down of the U.S. EC-121 reconnaissance plane, which occurred over the Sea of Japan in April 1969. Alternatively, it was easy to understand why the U.S. strategic leadership might not have liked what Sugina had to say. For example, in the article, he described the situation the day after the Pueblo was seized, when Soviet Colonel General Alexander Khrushchev, the principal Soviet military advisor in Prague, explained to the most Soviet senior members of the Czechoslovak leadership what had happened. The entire operation went off smoothly, incredibly smooth. The Pueblo crew, to a man, capitulated. They did not fire a shot. Frankly, we thought it would be much more complicated. The Americans were so bewildered that they failed to destroy thousands of documents. It will take our experts quite a while to analyze them. We all heard about what a great communications and command systems the Americans have, how they use computers, how they respond instantly to an attack. Well, yesterday it took Washington literally hours to pull itself together, just like we're doing with this Egyptian situation right now. Okay? Day late and a dollar short. This is a precise example of how the most advanced military technology cannot compensate for a lack of will and leadership. Good lesson. The preface to the article by Sugina was particularly interesting. After introducing the author, the editor acknowledged that the article had been excerpted from his forthcoming book. Much of what he reports here cannot be confirmed because of the rarefied circles in which he moved, but he has been interviewed at length by digest editors, and specific references that could be cross-checked have been painstakingly investigated, and no contradictions have been discovered. Similar findings were reported by Lord Chalfont in 1975 when he wrote of the series of three articles for the Times of London. No one, to my knowledge, including top U.S. and British intelligence and counterintelligence specialists who worked with Sugina, ever found any honest reason to question his bona fides. We're down to 1 minute, so I'm going to say a sayonara, and we'll close with a tune.